The streetlights come on. It's getting dark. She's supposed to be home before the streetlights come on. She wasn't home yet, so I'm thinking she's just out there playing with a friend. She never came home.
She should be playing with a friend. She should be going to school and enjoying herself. Not strangled, murdered, and treated like a piece of garbage.
Seeing her laying there smoldering has tore you up. It's one of those cases that never leave you. And Stanley's making sure of that.
There's no doubt whatsoever in my mind or heart that they have the right man.
He looked at and or processed 10,000 items of evidence and never found anything that connected Jennifer and Stanley.
I mean, I like cheese, but I'm not a rat. I like kids, but not like that.
You're listening to Suspect Convictions, a podcast from WVIK and Scott Reeder. I'm Lacey Scarmana. We have been re-examining the 1990 murder of 9-year-old Jennifer Lewis of Rock Island, Illinois. You probably noticed that we haven't heard anything from one of the main characters in this case. Stanley Liggins has been tried and convicted twice for the murder, but both convictions have been overturned. We've tried to interview Stanley, but he declined. He's currently awaiting his third trial in the Scott County Jail. But we've talked to people who knew him, family, friends, foes. They gave us context to understand his life, from his childhood in Mississippi to his time in prison. So, starting at the beginning, Stanley was born in 1961.
He was born the day after Christmas, December the 26th. Anyway, that was the first time I ever seen snow in Mississippi.
That's Margaret Liggins, Stanley's older sister. Stanley was born into a big family. He's the sixth of eight kids to his mother, Maybelle Liggins. The children had five different fathers. Stanley's older brother, Marvin Porter, talks about what it was like for Maybelle to raise all the kids as a single mother.
Mother was pretty strict, but she was a loving mother. She just, whatever she said, she meant that, though. You know, if you didn't obey her, you would get your butt whipped. There wasn't no spanking. I mean, just tie your tail up. Extension cord, belt, whatever they could get. Go outside and get a switch off a tree.
He says she moved the family to St. Louis when Stanley was a baby.
Mother didn't have a job, no father in the house, and it was three of us came to St. Louis. At first, it was me, my mother, Stanley, and my other brother, Newt, until we was able to get established for her to send back to get the rest of the siblings. And they finally came on up. And time was hard for us. You know, we didn't have anything, and mother wasn't on welfare or anything, and I started working at a young age, probably at the age of 14 or something. I started working at a Chinese restaurant trying to help.
Maybelle and the younger children returned to Mississippi in 1972. Stanley's younger brother, Dennis, says it was a hard transition.
You didn't have no running water, no heat, or nothing like that, you know. So everything that we had in St. Louis, we went down there, and we didn't have that. So you're talking city boys trying to go back to nothing. So it's pretty rough.
But Margaret says Stanley kept the family laughing.
He was always very generous, and he was always a clown in the family that made everybody laugh. He was quite a comedian. He was, and my mom always said that he was the best child she had in the house. You know, he wasn't as hard-headed probably as the rest of us kids when she said do something. You know, Stan never complained or anything. He would just do it.
Dennis remembers Stanley's sense of humor, too.
All I can say, I remember Stanley cracking jokes and singing. He used to love to sing Smokey Robinson. That song, Ooh, Baby, Baby. What a price to pay.
As a teenager, Stanley spent his summers back in St. Louis working on the railroad with Marvin.
Stanley was aggressive. He would get angry quick. He would start a fight quick if somebody did cause a reason. But Stanley was a good loving brother, though. He would do anything kind-hearted, do anything in the world for a family member, he would do it. He would give them whatever he had if they wanted it. He was free-hearted, kind-hearted with whatever he had. Because, like I say, he worked with me, and then he shared his earnings with other family members.
Stanley had a girlfriend in St. Louis, and they had a daughter.
Really, I didn't remember too much of him as a father because he wasn't around that girl that much because he's only been in jail for, I guess, about 20-some years. I don't know. I think that girl, and I don't know. I don't even know the girl's real name. I know they call her Pumpkin.
Soon after his daughter was born, Stanley got into trouble. At 19, he and a group of men were arrested for robbing a grocery store in Mississippi at gunpoint. They stole $400. Stanley served 7.5 years for armed robbery.
He had been working with me, and he went to Mississippi on a visit or something. I don't remember for sure what it was. And to go down there and get involved in something like that and had a job where he could have been working, yeah, I was disappointed in that. I didn't feel like he had to do that. He could have been working. So he went out and messed around with some of his cousins and things, and they just got involved in some stuff. But I was disappointed in him for doing that because I know he could have been working, making his own money, but that's what he did.
Margaret says none of the other siblings ever got into trouble, but she says Stanley's father did.
People always had stories about Stanley's daddy was crazy and did some of the same things that Stanley did. It was in his genes or hereditary or whatever.
Marvin says Stanley's father lived with the family for a few years in Mississippi when Stanley was still a baby.
I remember him being a wild guy that got drunk all the time. And he used to get in fights as well himself when he'd get drunk.
And did Stanley see him much after you all left Mississippi the first time?
After they moved to St. Louis, no. I don't think he ever seen him at all until they moved back to Mississippi, and probably not very often then.
Stanley did his time for the armed robbery at the Mississippi State Penitentiary in Parchman, Mississippi. Margaret visited him many times.
Matter of fact, during that time, I think we could go inside the cell, you know, and sit on the bed and talk or whatever. So he was doing pretty good, as far as I can see. Yeah, we would have dinner and stuff together. We did. And then, not just that, my mom always recruited other people to take down there to visit him, you know, for other relatives or friends or whatever.
But Stanley got into a lot of trouble at Parchman. He racked up citations for refusing to work, using abusive and obscene language, disobeying orders, having unauthorized sharp objects, and fighting. On April 6, 1982, prison officer Alvin Lucas gave Stanley an RVR, a rule violation report. These reports meant that an inmate's family visitation rights were put on hold.
If you got rule violation serious enough, then that canceled your visitation. Then your folks couldn't come. So I guess he wanted to try to get me to change that. So I refused him, you know. And he jumped me, you know. And, you know, it wasn't no real devastating struggle. You know, we struggled this and that, but he ended up biting me on one of my ears or whatever.
When Alvin refused to take back the report, Stanley kicked him in the knee and bit him on the ear and shoulder. According to prison records, Stanley's punishment was 20 days of isolation. In February 1987, prison records state Stanley allegedly threatened an inmate in the shower with a knife to have sex with him. And in September of 1988, Stanley killed an inmate named Tommy Blackburn by stabbing him about a dozen times. A jury found him not guilty on the grounds of self-defense, even though Tommy wasn't found with a weapon. Stanley claimed Tommy threatened him with a knife, which Stanley took and used to defend himself. Marvin remembers hearing about this.
I remember being told it was some guy tried to walk up on him and stab him or something, and Stanley threw him down and took the knife and stabbed him with it.
Stanley finished serving his time for the robbery and was released on February 28, 1989. He briefly lived with Marvin in St. Louis before moving to the Quad Cities.
I guess because I had other relatives there. My brother Newt was there. My brother Sylvester was there, and Dennis, and I think Margaret was there as well.
According to courtroom testimony, Stanley didn't have a job, and he began supplying cocaine to people in the community. In the summer of 1990, he met Sherry Glenn, Jennifer Lewis's mother. Sherry was pregnant, and her husband Joe was in jail. She was looking for a way to make money to bail him out.
I was selling pot because I didn't have enough money to pay for my house and my utility bills. I couldn't get no pot.
She says a friend introduced her to Stanley.
They asked me if I knew anybody who did cocaine, if I knew people that would buy it. Sure, yeah, oh yeah, okay. So they introduced me to Stanley, and one thing led to another. I introduced him to people I knew because I didn't want to be involved in it.
Stanley spent some time at the Glenn House, Mary Rockwell, a family friend who considers herself Jennifer's godmother, says Stanley was friendly towards Jennifer.
Stanley would come to the house. He was always very clean-cut, well-dressed, well-mannered, soft-spoken, very gentlemanlike. Jennifer had a little bit of learning issues, from my understanding. One thing Stanley did was Jennifer was learning to count money, so he would pull out a handful of change, and the agreement was if Jennifer could count it and count it correctly, he would give it to her to put in her change jar for her dad.
Sherry says Joe was released from jail on August 5th, 1990.
Joe got out of jail, I think, August 5th, which was a couple days after Stanley molested that little girl, Marlon, which I didn't know about.
Sherry's referring to Stanley's August 3rd arrest for aggravated criminal sexual abuse of a 9-year-old girl in Milan, Illinois. The girl testified that she spilled Kool-Aid on herself, and Stanley offered to help her clean it off. She says he used a washcloth to wipe the Kool-Aid off her leg and then reached under her swimsuit bottoms and touched her inappropriately. He was arrested and released on bond. A little over a month after that, the Quad Cities community was shaken by the murder of Jennifer Lewis on September 17, 1990. Stanley was charged several days later with Jennifer's murder, along with her kidnapping and sexual abuse.
What hit me is finding out that Jennifer had been killed and how she was killed, wanting to know who did it. And then when I found out or was told that it was Stanley, you know, at first I'm like, no way, it's Stanley? And then all of a sudden people started talking and then found out what he'd done before, and then he just molested little girls, like, oh my God.
Chris Miner, a reporter for WQAD-TV Channel 8, says the community learned about the Milan sexual abuse arrest shortly after Jennifer Lewis was murdered.
The fact that he was arrested for sexually molesting a 9-year-old girl and he was out on bond, and then 1 month later, Jennifer. You know, it's hard not to think, if he would have been in jail, what life would have looked like.
She interviewed Stanley shortly after his arrest.
When I asked him, you know, you had been arrested for molesting a 9-year-old, Stanley, and now this, do you like little girls? And he answered,
I mean, I like cheese, but I'm not a rat. I like kids, but not like that.
And the way he said it, and he stared at me, it was an interesting answer to that question.
Mary Rockwell remembers seeing that interview on the news.
When I came home, the first clip I saw was that where he says, you know, I like cheese, but I'm not a rat, and I like kids, but not like that. It was like a man I had never saw in my life, ever. Even though I'd known him through Sherry and met him on numerous occasions, he wasn't the same man. It was like Jekyll and Hyde. I saw pure evil. It was very frightening how buffaloed we were.
Chris Miner remembers something else from her interview with Stanley.
I think it was my first jailhouse interview of an inmate, let alone an accused child killer. And I was nervous. I didn't know what to expect. And I remember, you know, walking in the jail and the door slams and we sat down and there he was, cool as a cucumber. And I'm not kidding, I was a lot younger then, but his eyes, it was like he was almost undressing me. I remember that. It was creepy.
Lisa Toronto was a reporter for WHBF-TV Channel 4.
I was wearing dark blue pants that had white pinstripes. I had a white blouse on, and I had navy blue suspenders. And he said to me, hi there, suspenders. He couldn't say suspenders. He said, hey, suspenders. And he kind of smiled at me, almost kind of childlike himself, like, why am I here? And I like your suspenders. I didn't get creeped out. I kind of got confused by the way he looked at me. But what happened after that is he started writing me letters from prison. That's when I got scared, because all of a sudden this man was writing me after he was convicted. And I remember one of the police officers in the Quad Cities told me that I would be on a list if he were ever to be released, that they would notify me.
Pat Seitz was a reporter with the Dispatch and the Rock Island Argus. He interviewed Stanley after Stanley saw Lisa Toronto. And Pat says during the interview, Stanley made sexual comments about Lisa.
You know, I just met this guy, and he's already talking like this, you know, creep, you know. It's just weird. I mean, that's what I remember most about that interview. Just that, like, geez, you know, here's this guy in jail for this horrific crime. You know, obviously he said he didn't do it. And, you know, he's just got other urges.
From the beginning, Stanley has said he's innocent.
Did you kill Jennifer Lewis?
No, I didn't. And I don't have really any idea who did. I wish I did.
You're saying you did not, you're not the man?
I'm point blank saying that.
In the last episode, we talked about the evidence used to charge and convict Stanley twice for the murder. Iowa doesn't have the death penalty, so he was sentenced to life in prison. Stanley's mother died in 2003. Margaret and Marvin say it was hard for Stanley to not be with his family.
I know my mother's last request was to see all her children one last time, and Stan was the only one that couldn't.
I don't know how long it was before he even knew that she was gone. So she might have been gone a month or two before he even knew it. I don't remember for sure.
People convicted of harming children aren't usually treated well in prison. Gentrick Hicks is serving a life sentence for murder at the Iowa State Penitentiary in Fort Madison. That's where Stanley was before his latest appeal.
I heard his case reported on the TV, and so I was angry at him instantly, thinking that he was guilty because he was arrested, in jail, and charged, and his picture pasted all on the TV and everything. So I was angry, and like I said, till I got to know him and everything. And I come to find out, he's just not the type to do that.
Stanley and Gentrick got to know one another when they worked in the prison's kitchen.
I was raised up in Mississippi. I was born in Missouri, and I was raised up in Mississippi. And we had a cultural identity living in Mississippi. And cultural, I mean, things we did, working in the field. You know, we liked fried fish. We liked smothered liver and onions and the very southern amenities and things like that and foods. And so we got to talking and everything. He sort of reluctantly opened up to me, and I sort of creeped into getting to know him because I still had in my mind that he was a sexual predator of the worst kind. And just before I had read anything about his case, and when we started talking, he felt comfortable enough to allow me to talk to me about his case. Then he said, well, I'll bring something out to read it.
Gentrick says after reading about Stanley's case, he started believing in his innocence.
Because Davenport Police Department was so bent on framing Mr. Lane, you know, and I have to say, I don't like to play the racial card, but I'm 17 years old and I've been around long enough to know that we still suffer hugely in this country from racism, especially in the judicial system. African Americans just don't get the justice that they should. In this case here, they shortchanged Mr. Liggins from every turn, from every corner. They did not get this man justice.
Scott Reeder covered the Quad Cities police departments for 2 years, and he says back then, many officers openly used racially charged language.
I can remember hearing comments like, there's nothing here but TNA. And when police officers in that era would use it, what they were referring to is there's nothing here but typical Negro activity is what it was supposed to refer to. And when they would go and cover an altercation in a African-American neighborhood, the expression was, oh, just here, nothing here but TNA.
Former Scott County Prosecutor Bill Davis says Stanley's race did not influence the investigation, but he doesn't deny that some racism existed within the Davenport police.
Your police departments are a reflection of your community, so there's racism.
And Ginger Kick says other details stood out in Stanley's case.
When I started reading about his case and things that his lawyer had discovered through people calling his lawyer, reporting these things that the stepfather said.
Gentrick is referring to information included in Stanley's appeal. Kent Simmons, the lawyer who filed the appeal, claims that 78 police reports were withheld from the defense. We talked about these reports in the last episode. One report includes a statement Joe allegedly made about wanting to videotape sexual acts with his stepdaughter, Jennifer. The appeal also cites post-conviction findings, where Joe allegedly admitted to killing his stepdaughter. According to testimony in an evidentiary hearing from 1999, a witness claims Joe Glenn was arguing with a neighbor when he said that he killed his daughter and he would kill them too. The witness says he then rephrased his statement to say, quote, "They killed my daughter and you guys don't mean anything to me. I can kill you too." Sherry says Joe never said he killed Jennifer.
That guy didn't even know us then. Joe was drunk out there running his mouth. He did not say that. There was so much commotion going on, but he said, "Do you think Stanley killed Jennifer? Just wait until I kill you." But he wouldn't. He never said that he killed Jennifer.
She says Joe was all talk, and he wouldn't actually hurt anyone. But police reports show Sherry filed multiple orders of protection against Joe in the early 2000s.
Joe could run his mouth and say shit, but he wouldn't hurt a flea. I mean, I was married to him for 16 years, and he could run his, excuse my language, his fucking mouth. And I'll tell you what, the words are worse. Because, you know, bruises go away. But he liked to talk shit and show off. That's all it was. That's just Joe.
Joe took the stand in both of Stanley's first two trials. Here's a bit of Joe's testimony, courtesy of WQAD. Joe's talking about a phone call he had with Stanley the night of Jennifer's murder.
He was real irate and angry and was insisting on coming over to the house. I told him, "Did you hear what happened? They found Jennifer's body over in Davenport." And he says,
"Objection, hearsay.
Objection's overruled."
And he says, "That's a drag. And hey, dude, I need to come over to your mother's house." And I said, "Well, hey, man, you can't come over right now. The detectives want to talk to you. What do those son of a want?"
Former Scott County Prosecutor Bill Davis says working with Joe after Jennifer's murder was challenging.
It might come from an area where they're very proud of not working, because he's that kind of an individual, and he was proud of not having ever had a real job. And he lives by his wits. And he seldom says the same thing twice. That's why whatever he told us, we took with a grain of salt and investigated. And unfortunately, he likes to talk, because when you talk, people sometimes will give you an audience. And he likes the attention. And I knew I had to present him to the jury. And how in the world am I going to take this ragtag excuse for a man and put him in front of a jury who should be showing the grief that most parents would, and anybody on that jury definitely would be, and he's not orthodox in that regard. I'm not saying he wasn't grieving. I'm saying it wasn't an orthodox representation that you would observe a person, normally a grieving parent. So I had this to deal with.
But he doesn't think Joe is guilty.
We totally investigated the stepfather and his presence and where he was during all of this time. No. Only if you like to plant innuendo with a jury so that they follow breadcrumbs down a rabbit hole.
Sherry and Joe got divorced in 2003.
Remember you writing up your own divorce papers?
Yep, 4 pages long. Got sole custody of Damien, my main name back, asked not to be responsible for any bills we incurred while we were married. Of course, the Rock Island County Sheriff's Department said, "Good job, Sherry, how did you do it?"
Nobody knows where Joe lives now. In fact, Scott Reeder hired a private investigator named Kevin Fusich, but he hasn't been able to track Joe down yet. Kevin says the last place Joe was seen is a homeless shelter in New Orleans.
Do you think he is here in New Orleans, or has been in New Orleans?
Yeah, from all accounts to the address search summaries, he's been here for a while.
Scott went down there himself to search. He brought along an old photo of Joe and showed it to people he met.
I seen him yesterday.
Yesterday? Where?
Yeah, yesterday. I seen him down there on Decatur. On Decatur. He got the same hair and the mustache.
That's a 10-year-old photo now.
Yeah, I know. But he got a beard now.
Okay.
Yeah, he got a beard. I seen that face though.
You ever seen him?
If I'm not mistaken. Because after a period of time, they all go to look at the beard thing. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, this is a 10-year-old photo.
Yeah, but I'm saying, because see, sometimes they let the beard grow, but, I don't want to leads you the wrong way, okay? Uh-huh. But there is a guy, a similarity to this one. He bees this way.
Okay.
Back over here.
What kind of places do you see this guy at, just out of curiosity?
I don't know him all that well. I see him walking around here and there.
Does he panhandle, or does he?
I'm really not for sure, dude. I try to keep myself isolated from people.
Well, he may. Now, it's the same person I know, which has lost a lot of weight. He's got a ponytail now.
Okay.
He hangs out at Jackson Square.
At Jackson Square?
Jackson Square, down with the gypsies down there.
I haven't seen him lately now. I haven't seen him in a month. I know you're talking about, I haven't seen him walking around eating with us. I haven't seen him lately.
Where's he hang out?
Like everybody else, around the park and whatnot.
About around where?
Around here. Where else they gonna hang? Around here.
I don't know, maybe the library.
The library?
Yeah.
Public library. That's
you go in there and get on the internet. On the internet.
Bill Davis says it's good for the defense if Joe can't be found.
I think they'd rather not have him, so they can say anything they want about him, and he's not there to defend himself. And then again, they'll of course assure the jury that we hit him, but I understand the theory of the case for the defense. I understand the way Kent Simmons, who's a good friend of mine, he was my first intern. He presents the case big city style. Go in and accuse everybody but his client. Accuse the prosecutor, accuse the lawyers, police. Accuse everyone but his client.
Stanley's going to trial for the third time in May. Both of Stanley's other convictions were overturned, meaning he is currently charged with the murder but hasn't been found guilty of the crime. He has the presumption of innocence, like any other person facing trial. Stanley's first defense attorney, Gary McHenrick, says he doesn't think the prosecution proved their case beyond a reasonable doubt.
I have always believed that the evidence was insufficient for him to be guilty.
Stanley's siblings, Marvin and Margaret, hope their brother wouldn't be capable of such a terrible crime.
To be honest, I don't know. I just hope he did. I don't know for certain if he could have. I really don't know. You don't know. We don't know what the next person is capable of doing. And I've got to be honest, I don't know if he could have or not. I just hope he didn't.
I really would hate to think that he did it. Well, I hope he couldn't be my brother and be capable of doing some things like that. But I still, I'm not going to say one way or another because I don't want to set myself up for a disappointment. I really can't say because I also have to consider that child's family and people and everybody else that could be hurt.
And as for Stanley, he's always said that he is...
not guilty.
You have nothing to do with her death.
No, ma'am, not guilty.
Next time on Suspect Convictions, we'll talk about Stanley Liggins' first two trials.
Stanley stood up and started what all of us have referred to and my peers refer to as motherfucking the jury.
And we'll hear from some of the members of the juries themselves.
He looked kind of smug, like, I will never, ever get convicted for this.
I've grown up with black people all my life, in Africa, and most of them, they can be, I won't say threatening, but they do appear sometimes to be aggressive looking.
That's next time on Suspect Convictions. Production support comes from Alfredo Monteca. Thanks to Colin Thompson and Cast Media for our online presence. You can go to suspectconvictions.com for more information. Thanks to WVIK CEO Jay Pierce and the WVIK staff. All archived audio was generously provided by WQAD-TV, Channel 8.